Hey, what's going on, everybody? Alan, Kenny, managing editor, CrystalBallRun.com, the Blog UN Network's national college football blog. And Johnny Manziel, Johnny Football, he's been all over the place with a new scandal. This one, maybe one of the more serious ones that he's dealt with so far in his very short career at Texas A&M. That is an autograph scandal involving him being paid for allegedly paid for memorabilia autographs and to do card signs and whatnot. I've brought our foremost NCAA jurisprudence expert on, John Infante. He is the brains behind the Bylaw blog, and he also writes for athleticscholarships.net. And he's going to kind of give us an overview of what's going on from a compliance standpoint, and then we're going to talk about some of the bigger issues at play here regarding college athletics. So let's go ahead and bring him in. John, how you doing, man?
Good. I think to be an legal expert in this case, I got to have a cowboy hat or something, right?
I think so, man. Yeah, they got some wildcatters in there from like El Paso or something to handle this case, man. It's amazing. You know that firm that's representing, I believe it's representing A&M. That's the same one that did the Cam Newton case. Is that right?
Yeah, and I believe it's the firm that's now. Either run or he runs the practice group, Gene Marsh, who was the former faculty athletic rep at Alabama, former chair of the Committee on Infractions. They're one of a few firms that do that sort of stuff. Michael Buckner in Florida is another one. Bond something and something. It's a bunch of law firms that there's, 10 or so that they get most of that business.
But didn't one of them also represent like Penn State and Tressel, I think, too? I mean, you're kind of a slave to the fact pattern or what have you, but still, it's kind of funny that people think about, just associate this firm with Newton when you've had two other cases where it didn't exactly turn out so well.
Well, I'm pretty sure Gene Marsh was brought in to advise the trustees of Penn State and advise the president when they we're deciding whether or not to accept the NCAA's consent decree. And so, yeah, there's so few firms, this isn't something that's sort of spread around, but even, in big business, there's, a few white shoe law firms that deal with all the big, mergers and corporate cases. So in any sort of industry, I think you have a few law firms that are in everybody's Rolodex.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, one of the nice things about having you involved, and you as a resource when it comes to this kind of stuff is that you've actually, worked in compliance. You have a good handle on what it's like to be on the school side of it here. So I was hoping you could give us an idea, maybe just what it is right now that's probably going on at Texas A&M. You look at it compared to, say, Ohio State cleared Braxton Miller within minutes after seeing, all that memorabilia come up. Same with South Carolina, Jadeveon Clowney. We haven't heard any kind of official decree, so to speak, coming down from College Station. So I was hoping you could give us an idea about what is probably going on behind closed doors there.
So at this point, they're probably trying to just kind of get a handle on these accusations as they come, because, we were going through a 2 or 3 day period there where it felt like every time you logged back into the computer or turned Twitter back on, there was another, memorabilia dealer who was out there with a new allegation. So you would have started and basically, try to put this together. I would assume they would have interviewed Johnny already. The school will probably have started requesting some of that same documentation we expect the NCAA to request, like bank records, travel records, receipts, some of the specific things, now that you have an accusation that he received a specific amount of money and used it to buy a specific item, namely new rims for his car, then that may be the next thing that they're checking into, whether or not he, around the same time actually did get new rims on his car. And if he did, the school's probably asking him to show the records of how he paid that. If he, took money out of his bank account, they probably want to see how he put money into his bank account to pay for that.
Yeah, and that's something that they have access to. But, of course, there's kind of a workaround here because, as we found out in the past few days, Manziel has, I guess, kind of a manager that they goes by the moniker of Uncle Nate. And, some allegations are that Uncle Nate was the guy that has kind of set all these up. I mean, it sounds like they've kind of set this up potentially to be also kind of a Cecil Newton type case where Manziel's representative is the one who kind of handled all the business end of things.
Yeah, I have seen that thrown around, and also how, I mean, there's no shortage of articles that say how this is, you know, this is the Cam Newton case again, but they have the Cam Newton rule, so now they can get him, or this is completely different from the Cam Newton case because of X, Y, and Z. I think the biggest thing, you know, if the whole plan was that, you know, Uncle Nate Fitch was going to sort of be the go-between, handle everything. You know, Johnny, you just sign the stuff and let me pick up the tab for dinner or something like that. It's a very high-risk, high-reward, if you will, sort of strategy, because while Fitch, I think, is beyond the reach of the NCAA, they can't, you know, force him to turn over bank records or financial statements or force him to be interviewed by an NCAA investigator. If this did happen in that way, there is the risk that the NCAA can turn Fitch into an agent, which, you know, is kind of like when you talk about prosecutors indicting a ham sandwich. You know, mm-hmm. At this point, the NCAA can turn pretty much anyone into an agent or a booster. And if you turn him into an agent and then you find some violation where he was setting up autograph deals or was requesting money on behalf of Manziel, then all of a sudden the penalties are much higher than if Manziel was doing this on his own.
All right. Well, let's talk real quickly then. I guess one of the things that keeps getting brought up now is that also the NCAA, you know, is willing to make cases, I guess, on more kind of circumstantial kind of fact patterns. Is there enough here, you think, to build that kind of case if they wanted to go that route and don't really find the smoking gun, so to speak?
Again, I don't know how likely they are to do that in a case involving, you know, the eligibility of a current athlete, especially, you know, the eligibility of a you know, the reigning Heisman Trophy winner. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, considering, you know, coming off the Miami investigation, you'd like to think at least that enforcement staff and the NCAA generally want to make sure that, especially in, you know, about as high a profile of a case involving one athlete as you're ever going to get, that everything, you know, all their ducks are in the row. So I think it's less about them, you know, ruling him ineligible or coming up with a suspension based on a circumstantial case, and more building that circumstantial case to justify saying this case is open until we get your bank records or your parents' bank records or Uncle Nate's bank records. And if that means Manziel is still sitting out at the beginning of the season because some of those individuals won't cooperate, that may be where this, you know, sort of circumstantial case comes into play.
Okay. Wow, that's strong, Armin. Wow. So I guess one other quick question then, from A&M's perspective, I mean, what's the risk reward, I guess, calculation here?
I don't believe A&M is going to put him on the field unless they're pretty sure that he's not going to be ruled ineligible. I mean, if you do this without without being sure, not only are you going to have games vacated, but you run the risk of this turning into, you know, a bigger sort of institutional violation rather than a violation that one athlete committed that only affected his eligibility. So that's again where this sort of game of brinksmanship is going to come into play, where if we're sitting here 3 weeks from now and this hasn't been resolved and we haven't gotten, you know, anything sort of definitive, or the NCAA or A&M are still trying to talk to some of the key players in this, that's where they're going to have that tough decision. But I think, you know, especially after cases like Memphis and their major violation involving Derrick Rose, I think we're going to see that it's highly unlikely that he's going to play unless he's more or less been cleared by the NCAA.
Interesting. Okay. Well, you know, this obviously raises a bigger issue that kind of comes up every so often about athletes' abilities, of course, to kind of profit from their likeness. College athletes, of course, that is. I mean, that's essentially the what we've got going on with the O'Bannon case now, and you know, we've got memorabilia in this case that is being that is kind of at the center of the allegations here. Is there a way to incorporate this kind of arrangement where maybe, you know, Terrell Pryor can sell his gold pants or whatever they were, Manziel can do autograph signings and get paid? I mean, under the kind of common rubric of amateurism right now, I mean, is there a way to for that to actually work?
I mean, certainly not philosophically, right? So, I mean, the NCAA has drawn a pretty clear, line in the sand about kind of what they believe. And we saw that brought up again today with the comments from two of the chairs of the NCAA's, kind of most powerful committees who agreed to that. But if we, did sort of back away from that, either, the NCAA decided to or was forced to by a court case or Congress or something like that, I mean, there's a whole range of options you have here. I think it's sort of, the amateurism and professionalization debate has basically been broken down into, there's only three possible categories. So you do nothing and prohibit everything. You allow athletes to make outside income, what's called the Olympic model, or you just, pay them in some way. And within all of those things, you can, there's all these different, ways that athletes could make money or profit off of their likenesses or be paid by the school. And in theory, you can pick and choose any of them you want. So if you think, an athlete selling memorabilia, selling their jersey is less likely to lead to abuse or lead to the athletes being, cheated than athletes signing autographs, well, then you can have a rule that says you can sell your, game-worn jersey, but you can't, sell just your signature. I mean, there's no shortage of complicated, minutiae in the NCAA. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a cost to having complicated rules. I mean, not the least of which is it makes, more job opportunities for lawyers and compliance officers. But if you can get to something where athletes can make money, you find something that's, subject to as little abuse or fraud or exploitation as possible. And if that requires it to be, a complicated rule, then I think, having more compliance people so that athletes can get paid is, probably one of the few reasons that most people would agree to have more compliance people.
Yeah, no, I agree. But it just seems like you're going to end up, I don't know. I mean, you see this all the time. For example, I mean, I live in D.C. I see, laws being written, not necessarily written, actually written into law, but at least proposed all the time. And they always come up, it always comes up to be an issue a lot of times of, there's only so much that you can really cover specifically. It just seems to me like you're opening up such a huge can of worms for abuse, at least in the eyes of the public, regarding, say, boosters offering, $6 million to come sign some, cards or what have you. I mean, it just seems to me like it's so complicated once you start cutting it that fine.
Well, look, we, have rules now that say, the school has to monitor the booster's behavior, right? So, as far as we know, the kid is still, going over to the booster's house for dinner and just getting the $6 million,
yeah,
in a shoebox or whatever, not having to sign anything because then there's a paper trail. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you could say, well, this stuff is already happening. Let's bring it into the sunlight. But on the other hand, we have rules about this stuff, and like it or not, or, you can agree about how effective it's been, but the NCAA has experience in doing this. This is not something that it's totally foreign concept. Same with something like let's say, we want to let athletes have agents, but we don't want them to have bad agents who are going to cheat them. Well, then let's have a registry of agents. The NCAA has experience mm-hmm. in having outside vendors, like people who want to run AAU tournaments or people who want to run recruiting services, submit their business and details about their business to the NCAA that the NCAA then reviews to see if it meets their rules and then approves them. And then schools and recruits and coaches can then, you know, go to those events or use those services. So, I guess my bigger point is, you know, you look at that whole big complicated rule book, and each one of those places is a, you know, is a place where you can relax it a little bit without relaxing, you know, everything. Like, it's not a complete on-off switch. And the NCAA actually has experience in taking, you know, a simple rule that may, you know, look very powerful, but is just a non-starter. It's just not going to get through and be passed by the current membership, and, you know, work with it over the course of a year, over the course of a couple of years, and create a compromise that enough people can agree to that you can actually, like, get something done.
All right. Well, obviously, you know, I mean, we're talking a lot about these kind of bigger issues right now because, the NCAA, I believe today the announcement was that they were establishing, you know, a task force to look into streamlining the governance process and what that means. And I think that at this point, it's almost an inevitability that we're going to get some kind of new super division inside the structure. You don't think so?
When this comes out, I think my post should be up or following this, but so the sneak peek here is I think that at this point I would not bet money on that. I think the comments today suggested that two things. First of all, the fact that they immediately stepped in and said, you know, we're not looking at redoing amateurism or anything like that. So to me, it says there's not like this whole, you know, open market philosophy behind the idea of a super division. You know, this is not going to be 64 schools that want to immediately start paying players, right? Mm-hmm. These are the same, you know, you couldn't even get the entire SEC and Big 10 or Big 12 to agree on, you know, like how, whether or not we should regulate how big the note cards you send to prospects are. Mm-hmm. Right. And the second thing is that it's not this task force or meeting of the five families that's going to come decide, like, here's what it's going to be, and then say take it or leave it to the rest of, you know, Division One. It's the whole membership, a lot of engagement. We want to make sure that everybody's voice is heard. And again, when you put 340 people or 340, you know, plus schools together and ask them to all have their thoughts and do it over the course of a year, and you include the people who are in danger of, you know, being kind of shoved aside in this process, well, then you're less likely to get the type of thing that's going to shove them aside. So I think today was a big signal that you know, you can probably, you know, pump the brakes on a new division or maybe even a new subdivision, and you may just get a reworking and rebalancing of how power is, but still within the same Division One.
Now that's really interesting because, I mean, a lot of people have just taken it as kind of fait accompli at this point that that's going to happen. I mean, I guess obviously the big schools, the major conferences do want some kind of change though. I mean, would that then, you know, if you don't think that it's going to be breaking away, is there, I don't know, what kind of leverage would the two sides be playing against each other? Would it be, you know, the idea maybe of lawsuits against some of these larger schools by the smaller schools who might get left out?
That's one. I mean, there's also, you know, just the value that the smaller schools have. I mean, we've heard, you know, the bigger conferences say, you know, we have no intention of messing with the Division I men's basketball tournament. We hear this buzzword all the time about stability, where you have a lot of the conferences locked in TV contracts. You have a lot of, you know, the NCAA tournament is now locked in a long-term TV contract. College football playoff is now locked in a long-term TV contract. And certainly, you know, any sort of major shift in the membership of, you know, the top level of college athletics would, if the lawyers are worth what they were paid to write those agreements, that would, you know, trigger clauses to have those agreements either invalidated or at least, you know, opened up for renegotiation. But I think everybody's sort of kind of settled in for, you know, 5 to 10 years of, you know, a less stressful period. And so, you know, it might be a fate, you know, like you said, it might be a foregone conclusion that at some point there's going to be a split in Division One. But I think, you know, especially again with the comments today, I think it, or, you know, yesterday when this comes out, I think it will, doesn't look like it's going to happen right now at this juncture. So what would that look like, keeping the same Division One? Well, you might see the votes in the Legislative Council get redistributed. You might see membership of the Division One Board of Directors change. I think you will see the stipend passed in some form, because that's really the big, you know, it seems to be the only like big substantive issue that's pushing this whole, you know, this whole desire for change in how the rules are made. You might see a change to the override structure. And I think you'd see a change to Division One membership to hopefully, you know, keep Division One from continuing to grow the way it has.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I wanted to cover too, and you know, I thought that this was really well illustrated today when NCAA President Mark Emmert made the pronouncement that the NCAA was going to get out of the business of selling this licensed merchandise or these jerseys. You know, I mean, it was a fun kind of gotcha moment seeing Jay Billis, you know, out all the or you know, manipulate the search engine to show how the NCAA was actually, you know, using these players' names and associating them with the jerseys. But I think that what people don't really get is that, I mean, I think that people don't understand the business purpose of the NCAA for a lot of these schools. When it comes to stuff like this, because, you know, I think that people look at it as some type of big revenue source for the NCAA, whereas really, I mean, the NCAA from a business standpoint, I mean, it has kind of a dual function of being this pass-through entity, but also this entity that enables the schools to profit off of college athletics. I mean, do you think that's fair?
Yeah, you know, the NCAA does, you know, it is what the will, you know, it is the embodiment of the will of its members, right? So it's a membership organization, and the members control the NCAA, you know, generally, not the other way around. And so the NCAA is, you know, whatever the members want it to be. And for the most part, that's a, you know, an organization that runs a highly successful, highly profitable men's basketball tournament, an organization that runs, you know, a bunch of other tournaments that don't tend to make money, an organization that allows the schools to come together and pass rules so they're willing to compete against each other, and I think, you know, an organization that provides a lot of cover to the schools from criticism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's kind of elements in this whole, you know, jersey memorabilia thing of all of those where, you know, as Emmert said, you know, this, it sounds like it was just some sort of aggregator that it was, this was a system that like pulled merchandise that was available somewhere else and just put it up for sale. And, you know, a number of writers, when John Solomon is one, found that the same issue of, you know, not displaying a player's jersey as Texas A&M number 2 Johnny Manziel, but somewhere in the description of the product, you know, not something you could see, but something the search engine could see, his name was tagged to that product. So, you know, this wasn't just an issue with the NCAA's website. It was an issue with some of the storefronts that schools were running as well. Mm. So, you know, I think the curious thing, though, is just how much play that store got over the last 48 hours versus, like we said, the comments from, you know, two of the most high-ranking people in NCAA governance that said, we're gonna change the governance structure in a year, but everybody, including the have-nots, are going to be involved. And no matter what happens, we don't plan on changing amateurism rules.
Yeah.
And that was all snowed under by a story about the NCAA closing a store that they didn't make money off of, which I doubt very many people ever shopped at.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd have no idea that the NCAA had any kind of tie to that whatsoever. And it's funny because really all you're doing is just saying, okay, well, NCAA can't do it. I mean, it's just a portal. I mean, there's so many other ways to go about getting those jerseys from other places. I mean, the whole thing to me was just so silly. And, you know, but I think that the general public, and this is, you know, something that the schools have done a very good job of kind of, to a certain degree, manipulating, is that the general public views the NCAA as this cash cow or money-making machine, when really, I mean, it's just kind of there to serve a business purpose for them, you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a thing where the NCAA has come both, you know, for the, you know, efforts of the national office and the efforts of its members has become basically synonymous with college sports. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think, you know, you even get to the point where people probably, you know, don't even know that there's alternatives to the NCAA. You know, you can be an NAIA, and there's, you know, a junior college association, and there's a Christian college association. And, you know, together all those have, you know, as many members as the NCAA. But, you know, when you're the, you know, the dominant one in the market, when you, you know, when you have all the top schools in one place, then they're going to, you know, you're going to be synonymous with that, you know, with college sports in this case. So, you know, when people see that college athletics is as a whole, a billion, you know, multi-billion dollar business, which it is, I think it's just sort of assumed that all of that money is somehow passing through the NCAA because, in a lot of cases, a lot of that money, you know, in other leagues is. So, for instance, in the NFL, you know, every game that's put on TV, someone paid to put on TV, and all of that money goes through the NFL before it goes to the teams. Whereas in the NCAA, if it's not an NCAA playoff or not an NCAA championship game, the money to put that on TV had nothing to do at all with the NCAA. Mm-hmm. And the NCAA never saw a penny of it, never took a dime except for, you know, 10 grand, 25 grand, whatever it is for licensing bowl games or something like that. And the slice of the pie that the NCAA actually, you know, controls or has passed through its coffers is minuscule compared to the rest of the whole. I mean, the NCAA is one, you know, like two really big BCS conferences mm-hmm. worth of revenue and money every year. And they, you know, that's their threat, is that eventually, you know, that their members will outgrow the association to the point where either it's not worth it to them to have the NCAA in its current form, or when, you know, the NCAA just, the idea of it being this, you know, big tent that everybody can come together and hash out their problems and agree on it and then go play the games, they're just going to have, you know, too many 800-pound gorillas and elephants in the room to control them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really is just kind of a, you know, kind of a cost of doing business. I mean, I think that I looked at the, you know, I looked at the last, their last financial statements. I think they had, you know, total revenues in the, you know, $800 million range. But, you know, I mean, the expenses for, you know, just kind of the general operations, you know, not stuff putting on tournaments and what have you, something like around 38. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of the money that passes through there, the vast majority of which gets distributed back to the schools. So, it's a nice little whipping boy, I think, for the people who are really profiting off of it. But that's enough me, I guess, on the soapbox. So, I mean, do you have any maybe predictions, John, or anything, you know, any ideas about maybe some of the new ideas that might come out as a result of all of this?
So like I said earlier, I think, you know, today I really saw it as kind of being a step back in the ambition of any sort of kind of reform, especially at the top level. Again, there's always the O'Bannon case out there, and whether, you know, whether that survives, whether, you know, that class gets certified, and you may see, you know, settlement negotiations, which I think the judge has indicated she plans to send them to mediation if she certifies the class. I think that's, you know, going to be a place where, you know, the NCAA can say, well, you know, we don't want to give up amateurism, but we're kind of forced to. I think, you know, you look at this bill now in Congress that's being brought by a couple of representatives from Pennsylvania and Ohio to sort of beef up, you know, the due process, increase scholarships. But I think, you know, mostly what you're seeing in these kind of reforms is I think the big schools really just want more flexibility. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you have these multiple sort of outside threats, whether it's Congress, O'Bannon, the concussion litigation, mm-hmm. You know, the lawsuit that was just filed about schools selling photographs of athletes. And I think what they really want is the power to respond to that without having to come up with a response that is going to, you know, suit, you know, both Ohio State and Sam Houston State. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, because the stakes are so much different for across Division I when you talk about the O'Bannon case in particular, where, you know, one school might be losing, you know, $10, $20 million of revenue because they have a big TV contract. Well, some of the others, you know, they're not maybe not getting the same caliber of recruits because they can't pay out, you know, TV money under the judgment or settlement or whatever it is. But at the same time, you know, maybe they only lost $100,000 or something like that. That, you know, that's maybe an amount of money that's easier for them to go and find again and sort of recover from. So I think that's really the big impetus here. It's not so much that, you know, the haves and the have-mores have this sort of ambitious agenda that they, you know, just need to get these little schools out of the way of, and they can push it all through. I think it's more they have a couple of issues that they want taken care of, like cost of attendance scholarships or a stipend or unlimited food or something like that. And then it's really more about making sure that they're able to respond to whatever the next big seismic shift is in a way that suits them.
Oh, man. You know, you've really dashed my hopes here, John, because I really hoped that we were going to have going to the mattresses, you know. I mean, just, you know, lawsuits left and right. And this sounds so orderly and amicable. I don't know what to think about that.
But, well, these are like, you know, these are all like academics and college presidents that are making these decisions. And, you know, while that end of the business has been getting more contentious, it's still, you know, the academy. It's still the ivory tower. It's still, you know, it's still a place where most Americans' image of it is, you know, guys walking around in tweed jackets with patched elbows. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, the cigars and brandy crowd to a lot of people. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, I think it, you know, not since we haven't really seen, you know, that sort of knockdown drag out since, man, you know, probably like the 1980s when there were the fights about, you know, bringing women's athletics in or Prop 48 or something like that. And I just don't think you're seeing, you're going to see the type of changes, especially now where you saw that everybody's going to get to have their say and everybody's going to get a chance to be heard, and every president and, you know, maybe every coach and every AD is going to be sent a survey or something like that. I think, like, one of the things I think that most people don't know that is important to keep in mind is that right before, you know, the Penn State scandal broke and President Emmert called for the presidential retreat and started this whole kind of, we're going to quickly pass all these new rules, there was a push to change, like, the way NCAA legislation was adopted. And the push was to make it even slower so that rules might take 2 years to get passed at a minimum, because people felt that the manual was changing too much, they couldn't keep up with all these new rules, and that you know, that we didn't have like a brand new recruiting change every year, maybe a brand new recruiting change every couple of years. So remember, like, this whole push for all this quick reform is going against what was the prevailing kind of opinion at the time. And now you're seeing sort of a return to that where, you know, we're not going to have, like, by August, the big schools say, you know, here are our demands and here is the time to meet them. We're going to see by next August, you know, something it appears that's going to try to work for everybody still.
All right. Well, that's just not the romantic idea that I had in my head of, you know, some HBO movie a couple years from now where people are, you know, sitting around boardrooms yelling at each other. But, oh, well. Well, anyway, John,
Hey, you know, things can just be based on a true story. They don't have to actually be the true story. So
yeah, that's a good point. That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Anyway, John. I always feel so much smarter after talking about all this stuff. I really do appreciate you coming on and helping us sort through all this stuff because, man, it can be complicated at times.
And no problem. It's complicated for me, too, so you're welcome anytime.
All right. And thank you all for joining us, too. Again, that's John Infante. The site is athleticscholarships.net. Thank you all for joining us, too, for Crystal Ball Run. I'm Alan Kenny.